Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org to learn more.
Today is the 11th day of the Omer, which is the 11th day of our celebration of the resurrection of our Master. We concluded the festival of Passover, as you call it, with a beautiful resurrection service, followed by a raucous meal of Messiah. But even though the festival of Passover has concluded, the holiday spirit of the festival continues on until Shavuot, which our sages teach is the conclusion, the Atzeret of Passover. The period of time between Passover and Shavuot is called Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer, a 50-day count-off. And the first 40 of those days are days for the remembrance of the living Yeshua among us as he commissioned his apostles across those 40 days. So in that same spirit, the spirit of resurrecting, or of the celebration of the resurrection, I'm going to pose another of these questions, these simple questions I've been presenting to you, another of these questions about the death of the Messiah, the resurrection of the Messiah. Actually, two questions today. Here's my question. Where did Yeshua die? And where was his tomb? All right, it's really the same question, but where did Yeshua die? Where was his tomb? And don't say Jerusalem. Of course, we know Jerusalem. I already knew that. Come on, try harder. You may not be aware of this, but there's actually two contending sites in Jerusalem, both of which claim to have the tomb of Jesus. One is the ancient historical site, which has been revered in Christianity. Since the 4th century, Roman Emperor Constantine built a church on the site, inside Jerusalem's walls. Previously, the site was occupied by a temple to a Roman goddess, a temple to Venus. He said, well, that's a nice place. And allegedly, after his mother, Queen Helena, had a vision which identified this particular temple as, I mean, that's how the story goes. She had a vision. She said, oh, it must be there. So I'm referring to Holy Sepulchre. The other site, discovered in the last century outside of Jerusalem's walls, and it sits in a pleasant garden today, and this is called the Garden Tomb. So these are the two. We got, on the one hand, the historical Christian site, Holy Sepulchre. On the other hand, the more recent identified site, the Garden Tomb. All right. You might think it's not possible to know where, but it is possible to know. We're clever. We're clever people. And, you know, this is a, we weren't born yesterday. Our religion wasn't born yesterday. Okay? So it is possible to know. And today we're going to figure it out. Today, I mean, there's only three possibilities here. It's either the Holy Sepulchre, which is the traditional site favored by Constantine. It's the Garden Tomb, which is the location favored by Protestants and evangelicals. Or it's neither. One of these three possibilities. Today you've got tourists who are going to both locations in honor of the miracle of the resurrection of Yeshua. But it's impossible that both locations are the correct site where the miracle actually occurred. Now, I know 8 years ago, I taught this 8 years ago. So if you're here 8 years ago for the resurrection service 8 years ago, that's what I taught about this this very topic. So I won't be a surprise to you. And since then, my brother wrote a massive paper on this, which we published an abbreviated version of in Messiah Magazine, with the archaeological evidence and that sort of thing. A complete version, the unedited version of that same paper, will be released, God willing, with the hardbound edition of Torah Club Chronicles of the Messiah in the next couple months. But anyway, all that, neither here nor there. What are we going to learn today? Today, the Holy Sepulchre is an ancient church that's crowded in the old city Jerusalem among the other ancient buildings of old city Jerusalem, right there in the Christian quarter. And you know, like I said, it stands inside the city walls, inside the city walls. Not what we would expect for a first century tomb, is it? In the days of the apostles, for ritual purity reasons, tombs were always placed outside of the city walls. as a rule. First century Jews did not bury their dead inside the city walls. So neither the crucifixion nor the entombment of our master could have taken place inside the city walls. Now, if you're not from the high church background, and by high church background, I mean like, you know, the Orthodox or Syrian or Armenian or Roman Catholic confessions. If you're not from the high church background and you're not familiar with the iconography and the statuary and the other types of veneration which characterize that form of Christian faith, and you step into Holy Sepulchre, it can be an overwhelming experience. It was for me when I first stepped into Holy Sepulchre at that age, the age of 16. You know, it's like, whoa, here I am back in the Middle Ages. You know, it's a surprise. It's a shock. It's the gold. It's the gaudiness. It's the brass. It's the stones. You go in and as a young Protestant, It's like idolatrous in here, right? You know, it's like idolatrous. It's like all that, you know, it's a priests and monks and nuns and pilgrims and, you know, it's disconcerting. It's disconcerting to a young Protestant. And I always remember one occasion when I was there. This is when I was 16. I was there in the actual sepulcher. I was there in the church while it was being cleaned. I mean, they were cleaning the brass and the. You know, occasionally you have to clean it because of the soot from the hundreds and hundreds of candles that are constantly burning in this kind of gloomy, creepy place. And, you know, in order to clean it, they would use kerosene. So it just like fills the air with this smell of kerosene. It just makes you kind of nauseous, you know. So I have that sort of that memory of being dizzy and nauseous and anyway, it's a strange, eerie place for pilgrims traveling to it from evangelical America, you know. Like, what just happened? We come looking for some contact with the risen Christ, some personal touch, some place to anchor our faith, because this is the place where the big event is supposed to have happened, the crucifixion, and several yards away, the tomb itself. Instead of any kind of warm spiritual experience, we're bewildered by this step back in time, not to the first century, but to some pre-Reformation era period. And there's absolutely nothing there to suggest, you know, what you would expect. It's all marble and stone. There's one place where you can ascend some steps. You're going up some steps, and now you're supposed to be going up Golgotha, right? It's the Chapel of the Crucifixion, and there's this hole on the floor. Then when you get to the top, this hole where you can like reach down in the floor and touch the stone, the bedrock, okay? But in order to touch the stone, you have to be down on your knees. And if you're down on your knees touching the stone and you look up, you're right in front of an enormous crucifix. So it's very cleverly, it's cleverly worked out so that you actually have to venerate this crucifix in order to touch anything that might be authentic. I remember in 2007, my brother and I brought a First Fruits of Zion tour group into the church and explained what it was all about. And after this experience, one of the young zealots in the group, who was a young 20-year-old Gentile boy who was still trying to grow a frum-looking beard, which could match his frumish attire, we brought him through, and you know, he didn't have enough facial hair at the time to make it work, you know. But he took me aside from the group, and he says to me, "Mr. Lancaster, I have to rebuke you." You know, it's like, "Oh, you have to rebuke me." So, I have to rebuke you for taking the group into a place of idolatry. All right. That was maybe a bit much. But, you know, you're wondering, you're left wondering, and I understand the sentiment. Is this the authentic location? Does it seem likely that Emperor Constantine's mother is able to pick out the authentic location of the tomb of the master on the basis of a vision that she had that indicated the location beneath the temple of Venus? No, it does not. Meanwhile, outside the city walls sits an alternative site, far more friendly, evangelical place, called Gordon's Calvary and the Garden Tomb. You see, in 1883, so get there with me, 1883, the famous British general Charles George Gordon arrived in Jerusalem, and on the day after arriving, He's looking over a topographical survey map that the British Palestine Survey has created, this topographical map with the contour lines of the city and the hills that form Jerusalem. And he seems to detect in the contours the shape of a skeleton that's kind of folded in on itself. Anyway, he thinks he sees a skeleton in the shape of the hills and the contour lines. So he follows it to the skull and says, "That must be Golgotha, the place of the skull." Yeah? So he believed he had found the real Golgotha on this basis. And then sometime later, a tomb was found in the proximity of that location, a tomb. There was a stone tomb, ancient stone tomb right there at Gordon's, what we call Gordon's Golgotha. And today, Protestants and evangelicals and Hebrew roots Christians alike venerate this garden tomb. It's exactly what you would expect if you came looking for the tomb of the Master. It's located in a delightful garden outside of Jerusalem's walls, outside the wall line. And it is a real tomb, and it looks like a tomb. And there are people singing hymns there. And the place feels much more wholesome. And many people, you come and you experience this, and it's like, you just know it in your heart. You just feel it in your heart. This is the place. You know it. There's a problem. Your heart is wrong. The tomb and the tomb complex at Gordon's Calvary are not first century tombs. They're much older. They are Jewish tombs, but they are from the First Temple period. They belong to the days of kings and prophets. And perhaps the kings of Judah were once laid in those tombs. The location Gordon identified with Golgotha has no historical or traditional association with the place of the crucifixion. And the idea that it looks like a skull on a British survey map does not give it any more credibility as an authentic site than the idea that Queen Helena chose her site on the basis of a vision. What's more, the fact that the garden tomb is outside the city walls, we're going to see, doesn't give it a particular advantage either. So to sum up, the garden tomb has no historical tradition, no evidence, no actual corroborating archaeology. And in fact, the evidence of the archaeology contradicts the location. So the only thing that the garden tomb actually has to recommend it is good vibrations. Good vibrations that Protestant tourists get when they visit the site. But what about the other contender, the creepy Church of the Holy Sepulchre? Why should we trust Constantine's mother, Helena? She also claims to have found the original cross, So she wanted a church built. She picked a location, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, right? Why would we trust her? Well, the truth is, if you know anything about this, how Helena's pilgrimage to the Holy Land, she identified holy sites all over the land of Israel. But contrary to popular assumptions, she ascertained those locations by a different method than, she didn't just go on visions, she used a different method. She asked people that lived there where things were. She asked directions. Yes. So in those days, here's the thing. You might use a vision, because a vision in 4th century Christianity is probably like people would maybe like trust, like there's more veracity in a vision than a local. So you might use a vision, say, "Oh yeah, and I also had a vision, this is the correct place." But actually Helena used local tradition to identify holy sites all over the land of Israel. So here's my point. It is unthinkable to me that the location of the tomb of Jesus could have been forgotten by the believing community. It's unthinkable. It would surely have been remembered from generation to generation. So then you have to ask, then why this location? Why would Helena have chosen such an unlikely location underneath a pagan temple? Doesn't seem like the first spot. I mean, if I was Helena, you know, I would be looking for someplace where there was, first of all, a tomb. Secondly, a hill. A hill that I could identify as Golgotha. Or maybe a garden as well. There was no indication of anything there that matched the gospel's description. So it seems like it wasn't a very likely choice. And as I've pointed out several times, it was inside the city walls. So if she was randomly picking a location, there was absolutely nothing to attract her to this location. So why did she look for a hill where there was no hill? And why did she look for a tomb when there was no, where there was no tomb? And the answer is that the location of the tomb had not been forgotten. This is the location the locals pointed out to her. In fact, the whole Christian community of Palestine knew where the tomb was, and Helena only needed to ask. They knew it was there, under the Temple of Venus, right where the Roman Emperor Hadrian had buried it more than two centuries earlier, right after the Second Jewish Revolt. After the Second Jewish Revolt, Emperor Hadrian had plowed the city of Jerusalem and rebuilt the city as a Roman city named after himself. He named it Aelia Capitolina. Now, prior to that revolt, Jewish people were still, you know, they still were revering the Temple Mount. They went there to pray. They go to the Temple Mount to pray, and they were even trying to. They had hoped for the rebuilding of the temple in the days of Hadrian. And moreover, Jewish believers worshipped and even lived among the ruins of the city of Jerusalem. They lived among the ruins in those days. These people knew where the tomb of the master was. This was the community of Simon, the son of Clopas. We're just talking about, you know, we're talking about one generation later. So when Emperor Hadrian made the city into a Roman city in an attempt to squash the Jewish spirit, he did two things. First of all, he ordered a temple of Jupiter to be built on top of the sacred Holy Temple Mount. The abomination of desolations, our master named it. So he forbade Jews from entering the city. He said, Jews can no longer enter this city. And as far as your hopes for building the temple of God up here, I'm going to put in a temple to the god of Rome, Jupiter or Zeus. And the same impulse that drove him to build a temple of Jupiter on the Temple Mount drove him to build a temple of Venus on the city's other holy site, Golgotha, and the tomb of the resurrection. This is the early second century. Not even, you know, we're not even quite, well, yeah, I guess we're 105 years after the event, pretty much. It's the early second century. The location of the tomb of the master, the location of Golgotha were certainly remembered at this point. So Hadrian's decision to place a temple right on top of it is a good indication that this is the holy place that was being revered by the believers, by the Jewish believers and Christians, Gentile Christians both. So Hadrian has this statue of Jupiter on the Temple Mount, and then he comes and he levels off the hill of Golgotha because he's got to, you know, you can't, it's hard to build on top of a hill. So he brings in his engineers and they level off that hilltop. Boom, they just shave it down, carry away the rubble. Then he brings in all this fill, fills it in, flattens it out, makes a big level platform, puts in retaining walls around his big level platform, pops up a statue of Venus and the holy place of Venus on top of the location where Golgotha had stood. And here's the funny thing, you know, as why is he doing this? Well, because he's trying to put a stop to these holy places. But the funny thing is, while he's trying to suppress these two Jewish holy sites, he inadvertently marks their location for generations to come. So, after converting to Christianity, Constantine now orders the excavation. He orders the site excavated and a church built on the location. So his engineers set out and they demolish Hadrian's temple to Venus, and they begin, you know, they begin to carry off, to dig up and carry off the fill which had been used to level off this site. And they're hauling the dirt away. They're hauling it outside the city because it's been contaminated by idolatry. So they're hauling it outside the city. And Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, who's watching the excavation take place, he writes, "As soon as the original surface of the ground beneath the covering of the earth appeared, immediately and contrary to all expectation, the ancient and sacred monument of our Savior's resurrection shone forth. Then indeed did this most holy cave present a faithful analogy of his return to life, in that after lying buried in darkness, it again emerged to light and afforded to all who came to witness the sight a clear and visible proof of the wonders of which that spot had once been the scene, a testimony to the resurrection of the Savior, clearer than any voice could give." That's Eusebius' words. He was there. He was an eyewitness to see this excavation as they carried away the dirt. All of a sudden, there was a rocky scarp. There was the entrance to the tomb with the rolling stone. There was the hill of Golgotha, or the shaved off hill of Golgotha. Everything exactly as it should be. Constantine's builders wanted to put in a church to mark off the location. It's not so easy to do, you know, with a rocky scarp and what did they do? He wanted to put in a rotunda, and at the center of the rotunda would be the spot where the master had been laid and where he rose. And so what he did was he chiseled away all the stone except for that little enclosure. He just left a little square enclosure, a little rectangular enclosure of the tomb. So he got rid of the rest of the hill that the tomb had been cut into. You understand, all right? All right, so now it's just, and he carried that off, of course, and now he could put in his church, right? And he extended the church to then enclose that area of what was left of the hill of Golgotha as well, and he kind of used his foundations, encompassed that. And so this was the church of Constantine, and so it remained. You could go there. You could go to the church, and you could go in the church, and there was the tomb, you know, and you could actually look in the tomb and go in the tomb. The tomb in which our master had been laid until the year 1009, which is a long time. It's a long run. In 1009, the Muslim ruler Fatimid Caliph al-Hakim, be honor Allah, say that 10 times fast, turned against the Christian community, and in his conquest of Jerusalem, he demolished the church and hacked the tomb of Yeshua to rubble. He came in with mallets, and they smashed the rock to bits, carried it away. So there was absolutely not. Now the hill is gone, and the tomb itself that was in the hill that we were venerating, that's also gone. All right. So now there's nothing left except the ground that the tomb had been on. All right. And that's all that's left. Well, when news of this event reached medieval Europe, this sacrilege, you know, what the Muslims have done, it ignited a series of wars that we call the Crusades. And in France, they said, you know who did this? It was the Jews. And the Jews were blamed and exiled from a lot of France for what the Muslims had done to the tomb of Christ, which always makes sense. And then the Crusaders arrived. It wasn't easy to retake Jerusalem, but once the Crusaders had retaken Jerusalem, they rebuilt on the site, and they rebuilt the church there. And the church that the Crusaders built is essentially what's standing there now. I mean, it's gone through several renovations and reconstructions since then. There's been a fire, there was a collapse, there was an earthquake. More or less, the church there is from the Crusader era and from Reconstruction in the 19th century. Isn't it still inside the walls? How do you account for that? Because that's the main thing that Garden Tomb people always say. Yeah, the Catholic place is inside the walls. Jews didn't bury inside the walls. That's true. But here's the thing. It wasn't inside the walls in the days of the Master. Do you remember King Herod Agrippa? King Herod Agrippa I, the one who died in Caesarea, the one of whom they were saying in Caesarea, 'Tis not the voice of a man, but the voice of a god. And he was struck down in the stage in Caesarea. The one who put Peter and James to death. Or he was going to put Peter to death. He put James to death. He was going to put Peter to death. But Peter got out of prison when an angel came and let him out in the middle of the night. That Herod Agrippa. All right. That particular Herod Agrippa expanded the wall lines of Jerusalem. Expanded the wall lines of Jerusalem to accommodate a larger population. He enclosed the area in which the Master's tomb had been. So in the days of Yeshua, no, the tomb was not inside the city walls. In the later apostolic era, it was encompassed in a new wall line. All right, so, and we have the historical information and the archaeology with that. We can demonstrate this. So that's actually not an objection whatsoever. All right, so that's the story. That's Holy Sepulchre. Today, you go to Holy Sepulchre, there's this uneasy alliance of six different orders of the church, including Orthodox, Armenian, Coptic, Roman Catholic, custodians over the church. Other sects of Christianity and have smaller shrines within this large catacomb-like edifice, and every so often, these different versions of Christianity come to fisticuffs. Over control of various sections of the church is often turns very violent, where you've got priests slugging it out and that sort of thing. Just a few years ago, the Coptics and the Ethiopian Orthodox priests got into a ruckus over somebody moving a chair. Because nothing, it's like somebody moved a chair and it caused this big riot, you know. 11 were hospitalized. While I was in Jerusalem with my son Isaac several years ago, we're just watching the evening news, you know, and just watching in amazement as Israeli police in riot gear are pouring into the tomb of the Holy Sepulchre to break up this big scuffle between the Armenians and the Coptics. You know, it's like, I don't remember which was which, but the Armenians had some sort of procession that they always did, and the Coptics didn't like it, and so the Coptics had been like standing there, like, you know, or maybe it was the other way around. I don't remember who was who, but the thing was, it came to immediately had all these guys just duking it out. Boom, boom, boom. Tomb of Jesus. And, you know, it's like, this is funny. It's a funny thing. But this thing of moving a chair could start a riot. Nothing can be moved because nothing can be agreed on whatsoever. So, I mean, the symbol of this is the ladder on the window ledge outside the church's entrance because, you know, someone at some point, nobody really knows why that ladder's there, and there's a lot of different explanations why the ladder is outside the window, but it's been there since the 18th century. It's a step ladder outside the window, up on a balcony. It cannot be moved. It's a matter of politics between the various sects who owns that balcony. And so you cannot move anything from the balcony. It's 154 years that the ladder has been leaning against that window. In fact, the Jews now call it the Sulam Hastatos Quo, which is the status quo ladder. The ladder is referred to as immovable due to an understanding that no cleric of the six ecumenical Christian orders may rearrange any property without the consent of all six orders, which never happens. So, you know, and it's never been moved, 154 years, except one night when some friends of my brother from Jerusalem University College decided to test that theory, and they broke into the compound and climbed the walls and scaled the wall, got up on the ledge, and took the ladder down and left it in the courtyard. And then the next morning, they went to the Holy Sepulchre, and there was that ladder back up under the window. So it's a symbol of how deeply, you know, how much this distrust between the, which is understandable, these different sects of Christianity, but they have this in common. They have this holy site in common. I mean, they don't like each other, but they don't have a choice. This is the spot. It doesn't matter if you know, this is where it happened. So, in fact, nobody trusts each other. So none of the branches of Christianity that operate there and do mass there every day are allowed to have the keys to the place. The keys are held by the Muslim community. So it's the only way. It's the only way that we could, you know, every morning, a Muslim man comes and unlocks the doors. And then, after the last mass is said in the evening, he closes it up and locks the place up. But archaeology within the church has discovered that the location does stand on an actual first century burial site, first century tombs. And there's a small backroom chapel, next to the sepulcher, where one can actually see a first century tomb niche cut into the bedrock. In fact, you can get in it. And tradition identifies this as the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. You know, to me, it's unthinkable that the location of the tomb could be contested, that it would even be contested. The apostles and the first Jewish believers certainly venerated this location. The empty tomb was for them the greatest of all trophies. And if Judaism could preserve the site of Machpelah, the tomb of Abraham, or Hever Rachel, the tomb of, you know, Hever Rachel, the tomb of Rachel, and the tomb of Joseph for more than 2,000 years, I mean, come on, the Jewish believers could handle remembering where the master's tomb was for one generation. And then came the Jewish war, and the believers' flight to Pella, and the Jewish believers returned to Jerusalem, until the Bar Kokhba revolt, at which point Hadrian banned Jews from the city, but the Gentile Christians remained in the city. And you had the first Gentile bishop of Jerusalem at that time, a guy named Marcus. You know, immediately, there is continuity between the communities. There was no difficulty in determining the sacred location, and just in case you wondered about it, Hadrian marked the location for centuries to come. So then, two centuries later, when Queen Helena comes looking for holy sites, they can tell her exactly where to find it. So archaeologists and serious scholars agree that the tomb of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem is the authentic site. My brother knows Gabi Barkai. Gabi Barkai is the preeminent archaeologist of Jerusalem. And he lectures on this topic from time to time. You can hear his lecture on this topic. He basically presents the archaeological information, says, he says, there is no question this is the place. The hill of Golgotha once stood there. Now only the bedrock of the hill remains. Because, you know, like I told you, it was chipped away, it was carried away. The tomb itself, just a stone's throw away from where the crucifixion occurred, is completely gone. Even the hill around it is gone. Everything's gone. Only a stone edifice stands to mark the original location. I mean, there is this stone structure. This is where it was. It's ironic. By all appearances, there is nothing authentic to recommend this site as the real location of the miracle. But if you take the time to look at it more carefully, if you take the time to remove the debris of the centuries, and remove the idolatrous shrine that conceals it, underneath all these layers, you find an authentic Jewish holy site, the authentic tomb of Yeshua. And there's some lessons in this for all of us. There's some lessons for those who vilify the church and conventional Christianity. Oh, it's pagan, it's apostate, you know, it's... Be careful. You're treading on holy ground. And that church that looks so pagan and so apostate to you might actually contain the authentic thing. And on another note, for me, the story of the Holy Sepulchre seems like a metaphor for the Messiah himself, as Eusebius pointed out. The story of the Holy Sepulchre can be compared to the concealment of and the revelation of Yeshua. By all appearances, there's nothing authentic to recommend this. You know, there's nothing, to recommend the man of faith in Yeshua of Nazareth. You know, Christianity looks at him and sees, Christianity doesn't see anything Jewish in the fellow. The nations have dressed him up to, he doesn't look anything like the Jewish Messiah should. Judaism looks at him and sees only icons and crosses and statues and things that associates with idolatry. The secular world looks and sees only these edifices and cannot see past the surface to find the evidence, the historical evidence of the living, risen Messiah. But if you will take the time to dig at the foundations and to consider the history, to look past Christian tradition and Jewish objections, and if you look and you take the time to actually get down on your knees, which you would have to in order to get into that little tomb and to peer into that tomb like Mary Magdalene did, you will find the real empty tomb, and you will see angels, and you will hear the message. He's not here. He is risen. And you will turn and discover the living Messiah, the King of the Jews.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your souls.